Thank you very much, and I really do appreciate CRM and Fields and PIMS for the award, and thank everybody for coming today. Most people try to figure out how to make things complex, take complex things and make them simple. I'm doing the opposite, trying to make simple things into more complex things, and I'll explain why. A lot of my ideas today come from talking to my colleagues and students and papers with some of the people here. I bother a lot of people more than this, but this is just the people relevant to the talk today. Let me start off by something which is kind of reasonably well understood. If you're in the world of discrete computation, it's a different story for continuous computation. We really have a pretty well-accepted idea of what an algorithm is. For the last, say, 70 years at least, the Church-Turing definition of what it is to be computable is well accepted, and we have that idea of an algorithm as something computed by, say, a Turing machine or a random access machine, and everybody sort of agrees this is the idea of what an algorithm is. At the risk of really simplifying what computer science is way beyond what it should be, Richard Karp has said computer science is the systematic study of algorithms. So if it's a systematic study of algorithms, that's what I'd like to do is see just how systematic it is. It's hard to talk about anything about algorithms and complexity without mentioning Steve Cook's work. What I did is plagiarized two of his slides from his 1999 prize talk, and he had two slides. One was supposed to be the good side of the story, proving upper bounds, that is, good results, getting good algorithms for many problems. And in this sense, there is a rich, well-developed methodology, including many interesting tools for developing algorithms, linear programming, dynamic programming. And we'll talk about these things, in particular today, greedy algorithms. And these are taught in every undergraduate computer science curriculum. Good. So, and the other side of the coin is proving negative results. And here, one does have some results based upon diagonalization and reductions and counting arguments for circuits. And what we have is some success, actually rather good success, if the problems are very difficult. But there's really been no success whatsoever in proving negative results, saying something can't be done very efficiently if the problem isn't too difficult. Okay, and for those who know what the world of NP-complete problems are, that's a good way to say it, anything that sort of can be framed within that paradigm. In particular, the kind of common problems you tend to deal with in everyday scheduling problems, in number theory things like factoring integers. In order to get into the very hard things, you have to get into, say, decidable theories and things like that. But for the common things that people compute with, we tend not to be able to say, be able to prove that they can't be done. We have good evidence, we believe, but we cannot prove that they can't be done efficiently. So about 10 years after Steve's talk, and maybe, I guess, a good 35 years after his seminal work in this area, the status is pretty much the same. But it's really a question of whether or not, you know, how you want to look at it. I think complexity theory, that is this whole idea about trying to understand what we can and can't do, has been very successful in a number of different directions. And I don't want to go through it all, but I do want to argue that we've really learned a lot about computation. And the whole point of thinking about this negative point of view about what we can't do has led us to be able to, fields like cryptography, complexity-based cryptography, understanding and use of pseudorandomness. Coding theory has been revolutionized to a large extent. But in spite of tremendous amounts of I think, progress, both about what we can and can't do, and some of those lists of things about the successes are why we cannot prove lower bounds, but we still are faced with this fundamental barrier. If you take an explicit problem, and I'll say just an NP problem, but don't worry about that, just some explicit problem that you're familiar with, we can't prove that it cannot be done in, say, time, order, n log n. Okay. So, in the same time, people, probably the common perception is that algorithm development has been much, much more successful. And what I'd like to argue is it has been very successful, but it also has its bad side, its half-empty side of things. So certainly there's been a lot of success in terms of, say, semi-definite programming approximations, and particularly we've moved into, the field has moved into new areas such as algorithmic game theory, algorithmic mechanism design, and for those who heard John Kleinberg's talk, algorithmic social networks. Okay. Good. But here's a different perspective, sort of the kind of the half-empty view of algorithm development. So what I'd like to do today, my title really should have been something like an attempt at a more systematic study of some simple combinatorial algorithms for combinatorial search and optimization problems. So we're going to restrict attention to search and optimization problems and those that are combinatorial, like scheduling problems, not in the discrete world as opposed to the continuous optimization. And the words that stay in quote there will remain in quotes, simple. I'm going to give some examples of it, but never define what simple really means. Probably one of the most overused words in mathematics. And even the idea of what is a combinatorial algorithm is never defined. We talk about those things, and sometimes people give linear programming or semi-definite programming algorithms and say, it'd be nice if we had a combinatorial algorithm. Well, okay, whatever that is. So beyond that, even when I'm looking at search and optimization, I'm going to focus more on problems where and whenever you do search or optimization problems, you have to have a notion of what a feasible solution is. And there's a more general sense of defining a feasible solution. But in my case, I'm going to be looking at problems, and this takes a good bulk of the problems in optimization, where there's a nice one-to-one correspondence between an input is a input item, say, and there's a nice correspondence between each input item and a decision you're going to make about it. So just a good thing to keep as a running example, and we'll use a very specific running example, is in any scheduling problem, you have jobs that have to be scheduled, and you have to make a decision about each job, where to schedule it, and whether to schedule it. And so you make one-to-one correspondences between inputs and what you're going to do with them. Okay. I'm also going to talk about the idea of worst-case analysis and approximation ratios, and nothing about the definitions for some of these simple algorithms have anything to do with worst-case analysis. It's just a typical thing we tend to do. And moreover, even though I'm going to completely restrict myself to these search and optimization problems, things like dynamic programming have a meaning that go way beyond its initial use in optimization as Bellman first envisioned it, but it's a technique that goes way beyond that. Good. So that's a little bit of the setup, and let me tell you where I came to this subject from. I teach a course often that almost every computer science department teaches, something usually called algorithm design and analysis. Okay, and I think you'd probably find that in every computer science curriculum. And the way these courses get organized almost invariably, and the way the text are written for it, is that you tend to, instead of, saying, here's algorithm one, here's algorithm two, here's algorithm I for some large I, you tend to try to group the algorithms together and talk about some common theme, okay? And the common theme are these kind of simple, conceptually simple algorithms that we tend to try to emphasize and sort of say, gee, here's a tool that we can, sometimes people call them meta-algorithms, here's a tool that we can be using in many, many different setups, okay? And that's probably the most common way that any of these courses are organized. And so, and in computer science, we call this probably the main theory course in almost every computer science curriculum. There's other theory courses we give, but this is one course that every undergraduate takes. So this is the main theory course, and the main organizational tool is to talk about these algorithmic techniques, and we don't define them. Okay, so this is a mathematically oriented theoretical course in computer science in which the main topic of discussion is not defined. Okay. That doesn't seem like a satisfactory situation. As I say, what we teach in these courses are these so-called paradigms or meta-algorithms, whatever you want to call them. I think almost every course would have something about greedy algorithms, divide and conquer, dynamic programming, and then you tend to do other things in graph searching or flows, and it goes on, and you can it's just a question of how fast you can talk and how much you want to impress your students, whatever. So this is, and then orthogonal to these sort of generic techniques, there are things like reductions and randomization and things like that, which can be applied almost to any algorithmic technique. Good. Okay, so that's the setup, and then I tend to hallucinate a lot, and I think that students really are asking me interesting questions, and sometimes they really do, and sometimes I just make up the question as if they did ask it. And the kind of questions that I think they should be asking, at least, is, you know, you're talking about greedy algorithms sometimes, and you go on and you say, okay, let's go on to the next technique. And then, well, why do we go on to the next technique? Okay, and so, well, what is the difference between these techniques? And so we teach things, Dijkstra's algorithm for shortest paths between two points in a graph, two nodes in a graph. Is that dynamic programming? Is that greedy? Well, that's kind of an esoteric question maybe, but we might ask, we tend to do Dijkstra's algorithm, which can be seen as a sort of a greedy algorithm when all the edges in a graph are positive or non-negative, but if you can have negative edges but no negative cycles, then we tend to use dynamic programming. We don't seem to be able to get Dijkstra to work. We know it doesn't work and nothing like it works. Was that an accident or is there any evidence for that? Similarly, when we get to bipartite matching, we have given up on dynamic programming and greeting. We sort of go to network flows. And again, we never really emphasize it too much, but why did we give up on those other techniques? Okay, good. So, and of course, it seems clear that if you're going to argue that something cannot be done by a greedy algorithm, or something cannot be done by dynamic programming, or something cannot be done by whatever X is, then you have to have definitions. Okay, so to me it seems obvious that this is something you should be doing, but it's not obvious to everybody. So let me say why a lot of people think this is a useless activity. It's not the only thing I do that people think is useless, but this is one of them. So, you know, often the way you answer this question, or I've seen it answered in many courses, is if somebody says, well, what's the definition of a greedy algorithm? Say, we're going to give you 10 examples, and you'll know it when you see it, which is exactly how obscenity is defined by the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay. So, a kind of a little bit more kind of historical view of this is that Samuel Johnson's all theories against the freedom of the will, all experience for it. So when you start to theorize on these things too much, you lose the essence of what you're doing. Okay, or as my students would say, who cares? Okay. So no less than Bellman, who invented dynamic programming, really said the same thing. Okay, he said something like you can't axiomatize these things. Okay, meaning that you can't take, which is true, you can't take an intuitive idea, which is the way he viewed dynamic programming, and formalize it without losing something, or there's no proof that you've axiomatized things correctly. Okay, I mean, you can't even take the idea of computable, say, as an intuitive idea and give a formal definition. I mean, it's not a theorem that you've done that. You just have to hope that you captured it correctly. Okay, so, but Bellman was against trying to formalize dynamic programming. Okay, and he says only some things, he says, obvious what the dynamic program for it should be. Other things, you have to work at it, and only experience really does the trick here, and no formal definition is going to help you. Okay. So those are some of the arguments for why you shouldn't be doing this. And then there's another argument. Not only should you not be doing it, but it's been done already. Okay. So that's very discouraging. Alistair Card, our colleague now in computer science from philosophy, gave me this quote from Socrates. And this is true. I really, when I started doing this, had no idea how much previous work was done along these lines, okay, which is good. You've got too much about it, you don't want to embark on it. Okay, and let me just give you a little bit of an example, little bit of listings of some of the things along these lines. These are some of the top things are people who try to take classes of algorithms and understand them and talk about particular problems with being attacked by particular classes of problems, and some more formally than others, but certainly we're trying in this spirit to look at particular ways that you can solve problems and what are their limitations. Okay. There's other things where people have restricted models of computation, And some of those fall out of some natural considerations. Certain problems are online problems in the sense that you don't see the future, so paging systems or in many scheduling problems, things are coming at you one at a time. You've got to do something with it. You can't look into the future to know what's going to happen. Best of all examples is the stock market. So you have to do things as you go along. You have no choice but to look at online algorithms there. Okay? And data stream algorithms are another current example of a very popular model of computation where the volume of data is coming at you, just streaming through. You can't begin to save it all or process it all later. You have to process it as you're going along, and you're forced into it. So that's another type of work that's related. And then there's things in the whole, in proof theory, another area that we do a lot here in Toronto, not me, but my colleagues, and particular people will look at classes of proof systems like resolution and what can you and can't you do by short resolution proofs. So these are very related things. And I'm going to spend a good part of today talking about greedy algorithms. And so that has its own rich and long development and discussion. And so I want to mention some of the things along these lines and say what I am doing and how it differs from what's being done before. Okay? So the term greedy algorithms, I think, goes back to something in the 60s. I don't know that it appeared in print until around 1970 by Jack Edmonds, who was one of the main people in the early development of ideas and many ideas involving mathematical programming, linear programming. And he attributed the term to Fulkerson. And Alan Hoffman is also one of the main people. And the early efforts in greedy algorithms were along the lines of linear programming, where who were trying to solve some linear program and ask which ones could be solved very efficiently. And by a very sort of simple type of paradigm, this greedy paradigm. And what they meant by that was that at some point in time you have already determined values for certain variables, x1 through xk, and now what you do is you choose the next xk plus 1, and you choose the largest value, let's say it's a maximization problem, the largest value of xk that you can choose and not violate the linear constraints. Okay, that would be a greedy algorithm for say, a linear programming style thing. And that's what people like Jack Edmonds and Alan Hoffman were interested in. And Hoffman liked to use the word or thought the word myopic, or in French myopic or something like that, I guess. And I like that much better, actually, because it certainly there's no nice word in, I think, in French for greedy algorithms. And it actually captures much better the sense of what I have in mind for the types of algorithms, but it's too late. Greedy algorithms is common, and we got to stick with it. Okay. And the movie, you know, Greed is Good, really made this very good, very popular. So let me just mention that there are some beautiful formulations for, and what I'm going to talk about the next couple of slides, formulations for when, in some sense, the canonical, the natural, whatever you want to say, greedy algorithm, the thing that sort of pops out at you works. It either works well or works with some provable guarantees. And I think that sort of begins probably with the work of people, Rado, I think in the 50s already, or early 60s, Gale and Edmonds, who I think did the second half of the characterization, where they're trying to get a good characterization even of when the natural greedy algorithm will produce an optimal solution. Okay? And there's something called matroids, which is a nice algebraic sort of generalization of linear independence. And the only thing to really understand is that you've got collections of things, sets of things, and you want to have a notion of certain sets being independent. And the important thing is that in these matroids, the maximal size independent sets all have the same rank. Everything has the same the number of things you can have that are independent, all have the same thing. That's the rank of it, and that's what the matroids do. It generalizes that concept, and there's things, and then it goes way beyond linear independence to things in graph theory and many other fields. And probably the best combinatorial example of this is a forest in a tree, in a graph, any forest in a graph is independent, okay? And the edges are the edges constituting a forest are the independent things. And Kruskal's greedy algorithm is the natural greedy minimum spanning tree. In this case, you can apply it to minimum also, which sorts edges by non-decreasing weights. So take the smallest edge, throw it in as long as you don't form a cycle. that would be the greedy algorithm. It really is the canonical, the natural greedy algorithm. And and it's an example of a matroid and why you're going to get optimality there. Okay. There's other extensions of that, greedoids, which are a little bit of a relaxation to combinatorial things of matroids. Polymatroids have real vectors instead of just 0-1 vectors, and there are things like series parallel networks. And I guess a lot of this could be characterized as the natural greedy algorithm, which can be viewed as combinatorial gradient method algorithms for those who want to make the connection with continuous mathematics. And then there are things in transportation problems that Alan Hoffman and others worked on, and where something called Mohn sequences come up, and again, there's a natural greedy algorithm that you can use there, and they again turn out to be optimal. And then there's a whole development about maximizing so-called submodular functions, F, where it's submodular if when you add an element E to a set, the increase you're going to get there in its value is more than if you added it to a superset of S to T. It's decreasing marginal utility. Very important nowadays in people studying mechanism design. And so this is a very simple way of writing down what the greedy algorithm is here. Okay, you find that element which will give you the biggest bang for the buck, which will increase you the most. Okay, and you can prove results about this when you're trying to maximize that subject to certain independence conditions, and you get either optimality or approximations. And it's a very nice development. Nemhauser and Wolseley and Fisher are probably the main people who developed that. Okay, good. And as again, I think what I'm trying to, you'll see this, I mean, I consider this as a simple, conceptually simple algorithm. I mean, sometimes the analysis of these are not so easy, but I think everybody can see in what sense I mean this is a simple conceptual algorithm. You're just doing something very easy to express, and I think something that does sort of suggest itself very easy. It's very easy to construct algorithms like this often. Good. Okay, so that's the background. So what am I doing that's different than this? Well, nowadays, the notion of greedy algorithms has gone way beyond these types of topics here. Because in many cases, we have the notions of greedy algorithms where there is no notion of a natural greedy algorithm. There's sometimes no even cost function. You're just doing something, you're trying to maximize the maximum number of things, so there's no natural cost function, so it's hard to even talk about it in that sense. And other problems like the so-called band problem, where you're scheduling things, you're putting jobs on machines, and every time you put a job, just think of it as time, this takes a certain amount of time, you put another one on a certain more time. What you're trying to do is sort of finish, see how soon you can finish all the jobs. Okay, that's a very natural notion. It doesn't fit into any of these frameworks before, but very natural to study what a greedy algorithm would be there. Just put things on the machine that has the least load so far. Okay, so these things sort of jump out at you what they are, and yet, in some sense, even though you know it when you see it, it's hard to say what's the extent of what you can do with this type of approach. Okay, so, and many people would argue this is the simplest combinatorial optimization algorithms to design. I'm not so sure, but it's hard to think of things much simpler than that. Okay, so what with my colleague Charles Rakoff and a visiting PhD student from Denmark at the time, we define which we call priority algorithms, and I believe that these do capture a good hunk. I used to think almost all things that we call greedy, and now I'm kind of getting a little bit more, you know, realistic about it. But it does capture a lot of what we call greedy algorithms and goes and applies to things beyond those formal systems before, matroids or whatever, those other things, okay? And it turns out not only does it sort of give us a good sense of a nice way to formalize or formulate greedy algorithms, it also is a good starting point for certain types of dynamic programming and backtracking and primal dual algorithms. So it's certainly a framework that has some good amount of generality. Okay. Now, back for a second, so what is it that we want when we develop models? Okay? Well, I mean, you certainly want to, I used to think you'd like to capture everything, but you never can do that. No matter what you come up with, people will say, but what about? and there's always something that they say won't fit the paradigm. So you have to give up on that, but you'd like to capture almost everything that people call greedy. Well, if not that, at least most of them, or if not that, at least some. You know, you have to sort of, you know, figure out what you're willing to settle for. But you want to capture a good hunk of things that fall within the class. The model should be intuitive and reasonably appealing. It should be amenable to analysis. So the whole point of this, in some extent, is to understand the limitations of that approach. Okay? And probably what many people would call the holy grail for this whole activity, why do you look at any negative results? Well, a lot of people think you only look at negative results because in the end you're interested in positive results. By understanding what you can't do, you start to see the limitations and hopefully suggest new approaches that allow you to do things that you couldn't do before. I mean, when you can't prove something, maybe the reason is that it's not true. And there is a way of doing it, say, a simple way of designing an algorithm. Okay, and we can't rule that out. So that's, to some people, the only thing that matters. And if it is, then until that point when you really come up with some startling new algorithm, you're not going to really impress people. Good. So here's the model, and again, I hope at least it'll satisfy the first condition that it's easy to explain. It is easy to explain, but there is a subtlety to it which sometimes we've had a hard time explaining. So you'll get statements like this: a greedy algorithm solves a global optimization problem by making a sequence of locally optimal decisions. Okay, so that sounds okay, but you realize this is not a definition. You couldn't possibly prove something couldn't be done or done well by a greedy algorithm if that's what you're going to use for your definition, because it's just not a definition. Okay, so we want to try to hone in on this. And so, what are we making decisions about? Okay, well, some people would argue that you're just making decisions about, well, first of all, here's what greedy algorithms are to me. They, in some intuitive sense, you're making decisions about input items. We're going to think about an input as some collection of input items. As I said, in a scheduling problem, the jobs that have to be scheduled are the items. Okay? And what you want to do is consider these items one by one. And I think what many people would think is the essence of greedy algorithms is that you make an irrevocable decision about each one of these input items as you consider them. Okay? For a scheduling problem, do you want to schedule the job or not? Some scheduling problems, you don't have to schedule everything. And if you don't have to, do you want to schedule it or not? And if you do want to schedule it, where do you schedule it? Okay? But you could formalize that, but you know, you have to sort of say what is the universe of possible input. You have to say what are the finite set of decisions you're allowed to make. You then have this mapping from this one-to-one correspondence between input items and decisions into some value of the objective function you're interested in doing, how much money you make by scheduling things, how late did the jobs finish, whatever it is. And that's your formalization. You have to, in every problem, formalize it by saying what it's about. And that's fair enough, I think. Other people would say really the whole thing is about, then since we're taking this look at one item at a time, the whole greedy notion is caught up with who do you look at next. But I don't like that point of view. I'd rather say that there is some, we're going to talk about how do you figure out what order do you consider things, but to me the essence of greediness is the decision you make about it. And then there's some notion of what does it mean to make a greedy decision. So that's a better view, because if you have a problem which unit profit, what does it mean to make a greedy decision? What does it mean to choose the next item greedily? If everything has the same value, I don't know what exactly that even means, okay? Here's how to make this for any particular problem, okay? The framework is just kind of still very abstract and just talking about a general framework. If for every problem you want to talk about greedy algorithms for a problem, you have to say, okay, how am I going to represent these input items? Again, in scheduling, a job is the parameters of the job. When does it have to end by? When does it start? When can it start? How long does it take? How much is it worth? Anything like that. For a graph problem, it could be the edges of the graph and their weights. Or it could be the vertices and their adjacent neighbors and the weights. For a logic problem, say a SAT problem, it could be the propositional variables, and you'd represent the variable by the clause it appears in, a complete, say, description of the clause it appears in. Okay? Enough information that you can make decisions about it. Okay? And figure out in what order to see things. So then you have to specify what the irrevocable decisions are. And I would like to distinguish between certain decisions which are greedy and certain which are not greedy. And I'm not so concerned about that, because I might say no matter what kind of decision you make, we can call it a greedy-like algorithm. The greedy ones tend to have this notion of live for today. At any point in time, do what's the locally optimal thing, as if the world was going to end tomorrow, or TTC wasn't going to run tomorrow, whatever, and you just have to do something right now to make as much money or cost you as least as possible. Okay? So that's something you can formalize for most problems and say what a reasonable greedy decision would make. Okay? Good. But I'm not too worried about that, although it's something, again, because greedy has such a kind of common meaning, it's worth keeping in mind. And now, finally, I think the key point here is, in what order do you see things? Okay? Now, clearly, if I was able to look at the whole input and figure out what an optimal solution is, especially in, say, a problem where I'm just sort of saying, which jobs do I want to schedule, I'll just take the optimal order. In almost all problems, there's some notion of some optimal order. So I get this optimal order, and I'm a genius, right? I took exponential time, but I got the optimal order, and now I did everything perfectly. Okay? So that's not very useful. So you have to have some restriction. Now, one of the things you could say is, okay, you must decide who to look at next in polynomial time. But that gets us back into this, what I call this Turing tar pit, or many people call the Turing tar pit, the inability to say what you can and can't do in polynomial time. So we don't want to take that point of view. We want some sort of kind of more, I don't know what the word is, more logical, more syntactic, more local notion of what you can and can't do. Okay? And so here's what it comes out to be after, in hindsight, what it comes out to be. We really want orderings that satisfy, in the world of social choice theory, Arrow's axiom of the independence of irrelevant attributes. And what does this mean? It just means that we're going to take all the possible input items at any point in time that we think can exist, and we have to give an ordering to them. Okay? Now, the actual input items that we have are some subset of that. We don't know what the actual input items are, but we sort of know all the ones that they can be. A special case of that is just you take a function, some real value function, apply it to the description of each input item, get a real number. Okay, you might add up the parameters or divide or anything you want. It could even be a non-computable function. You take this value and then sort by those values. That's a special case where, given any two items, it doesn't, this independence of irrelevant attributes, given any two items, whether or not another item appears won't change the relative order. Right? If I'm taking a function of the description of the item, it doesn't matter what other items are there. Okay? And that's the key, that is the key restriction. Okay? In social choice theory, it's very problematic. I think in this setting, it's not so problematic. Okay? Good. So that's the key idea. So then you give this, and now we have this notion of whether or not the ordering is given once and for all in the beginning as a fixed order, and then you stick with that fixed order throughout the whole computation, or if you allow that every iteration, when you're looking for the next item to consider, you can redo the whole ordering again. But even if it's adaptive, where at every iteration you're doing another ordering, it still has to be amongst the still remaining possible items, it still has to be IIA. It still has to have that property. Okay? That's not only a very useful property in terms of capturing pretty much what gets done, but it also allows us to prove things, because now we can set up an adversarial game. The algorithm designer tells you what at any stage is, what the ordering is, and then the adversary can get rid of some things to start to refine what exactly is going to be the actual input. Okay, so let me just stop for 1 second, because this is really the whole essence of the whole framework. It's a game from the point of view of the algorithm designer to get good, efficient algorithms that work well in some sense. From the point of somebody trying to show the limitation of the method, it's trying to defeat that algorithm. And the way you're going to defeat that algorithm is that the algorithm has to announce at every stage an ordering on all the possible items that still could be around. The adversary says, oh, okay, I'll get rid of this, get rid of this, get rid of this. And then amongst what remains, the first thing gets taken, and that's the item you have to consider. Okay. Good. And by the way, in doing so, it's some subtle things go on here, because not only do you know certain things have already existed, you know certain things couldn't have existed. Because you know by the order you gave that if this is the first thing I'm seeing, then certain other things just can't be there anymore. Okay. So, and as I say, this allows us, we can now, you know, have a framework in which we can prove negative results without any recourse to complexity considerations. So that even if we don't have to resolve the question of P versus NP, it's completely independent to say what can and can't be done, say, by a greedy algorithm. You can have very inefficient greedy algorithms, as long as it fits the paradigm, or you can have very efficient algorithms that don't fit the paradigm. They're kind of, go either way, okay? And of course, in practice, these greedy algorithms, people make very simple decisions and very simple orderings. So in practice, the algorithms are very efficient. But as in terms of trying to say the limitations of what the algorithm would do, that's completely general. Good. And the only reason this is a little bit different from some of the previous things here is that we really don't have, like in, say, in the streaming model, the model is given to you. Here, we're making up the model, right? We have to come to an agreement that this is a useful model. Good. And then there's a huge list of things that you can say fit this, and I claim the bulk of things that I think of as greedy algorithms fit this paradigm. Okay? But it's also going to... paradigms also suggest things that don't fit it and that maybe you want to still call greedy, okay? But at least as a starting point, many of the most common things that are called greedy algorithms are indeed fit in this paradigm, okay? I don't know how much I should go through here. Sometimes you have to stretch the paradigm a little bit. In the case of, say, Huffman's optimal prefix coding, the normal thing you would think of an input item is, say, a symbol that you're going to code and its frequency. But in the end, when you're computing a prefix code, what you're doing is computing a prefix tree, so you can think of the items of being the nodes in the tree, and then a decision about an item is who its parent is. Okay? If you take that point of view, then Huffman's algorithm becomes a priority algorithm. And you have to stretch it a little bit more for certain other things, but most of the time it's pretty natural. And I do want to point out that, as I said before, even though this is all about mostly about today, about worst case, there are things like these random SAT threshold properties where one proves the positive results are proved using by these very simple types of priority algorithms. Even so, very hard to analyze. Okay. And then I should say, in many cases, the best thing known is a greedy algorithm, not always. Okay. So the other thing I want to argue is that even though the framework is extremely natural, there's so much scope here for input, you know, for innovation, that it's not easy to come up and think about what the limits of are. So here's an example that we came across a number of years ago from literature in the 50s in scheduling theory. And I just put it into sort of maybe more popular Olympic terminology, even though there's no biathlon, but soon there were. So if you had two events, a swimming event and a bicycling event, and because it's a very cheaply run event, you only have a one-lane swimming pool and a one-lane velodrome. And if everybody, you know, had a sort of an expected time to swim and an expected time to bike, okay, well, of course, each contestant is trying to win, but if you're running this whole thing on the cheap, your goal is to get out of there as soon as you can, okay? So that's the problem, and so an input item here is an item, is a contestant, which is given, represented by their swimming time and their biking time. Okay? So, you know, the first person jumps into the pool and they have to get out of the pool before they go on to the velodrome. In what order do you schedule people? There's no real decision, so it's just a scheduling problem now. What order do you schedule people in order to get done as soon as possible? And this has this particular ordering here. It's even a fixed ordering, but I don't think it's what you kind of think of, right? You know, start with those who swim faster than they bike in increasing order, and then amongst the people who bike faster than they swim, do that in decreasing order. I just don't, and all this is allowed. All that's local information that you can make a decision on that just by taking a function and applying it to, say, that pair. So this is this very local type of ordering decision, okay? So it allows, even a fixed thing allows a great deal of freedom. And here's what's called the natural greedy algorithm for the vertex cover problem. It's a graph problem where you want to pick out a subset of the nodes such that every other node is adjacent to something in the subset, okay? And what we're trying to do is minimize the, I'm sorry, you're covering all the edges, okay? You want to, every edge is covered by a subset of the nodes, and the nodes may have weights, and so you're trying to minimize the weight of the things you've chosen, okay? And it's a special case of set cover, and this is the algorithm that you would come up if you use the general set cover algorithm. You just, at any point in time, if there was no weights, you would think take the guy with the biggest degree, because that's the current degree, meaning certain edges are already covered, don't worry about those. Amongst the ones that are not covered, the edges not covered, look at that node that covers the most uncovered edges. That seems to be the right thing to do. And if it had a weight, then take that ratio. That would be the natural thing to do. And it turns out to not have a great approximation ratio is something like log of d, whereas we know it can be done in 2. And you have to modify that by putting in, not only do you have to keep on updating the degree, you have to update the weights. And then you get this 2 approximation. This is basically the best we know for doing this problem. And there's some evidence, we have evidence why you're not going to beat it for these simple algorithms, and there's evidence why you may not beat it at all, but it's hard to formalize these things. Okay, so now what I want to talk about for most of the rest of the lecture is one problem, and which I want to beat to death, if I haven't done so already. Okay, and this problem is a problem which most people would say is a solved problem. Okay, and I'll try to still convince you that it's solved, but there's still things to be asked about. So what's the problem is interval scheduling. If you're scheduling talks in this room, certain talks take a certain amount of time, and they maybe are scheduled, and maybe because of availability, this person can speak between 2 and 3:30. And if it's like a banker, they can only be here from 9 to 10. If it's an academic, they can be here all day long. It doesn't matter. But you'll have certain constraints. But let's say everybody has a simple constraint that they can be here at one time to start off with, okay? And then various people get paid for their lectures or they're going to bring in a certain amount of money. And what you'd like to do is schedule as many activities in this room without overlap. It's not good to have 2 talks going on at the same time. So you want to schedule without overlap. Okay, that's called interval scheduling, and you may have many rooms and you're just trying to do this. That would be interval scheduling of some number. And so you describe an input now is an interval with a start time, a finishing time, and the profit, a weight for what it's worth if you schedule it, okay, in a feasible schedule where nothing overlaps. And these are not matroids, they're not greedoids, they're not k-ians. These things don't fit any of those kind of previous nice abstract things, so you're on your own. And it turns out that if it's the unweighted case, that every interval counts as 1, then there is a nice, clean, simple greedy algorithm. Okay, and one would like to know whether or not there is a nice simple algorithm for the weighted case. Okay, good. So here's the greedy algorithm for the unweighted case. Okay, and this is probably one of the first algorithms that we often teach in these undergraduate courses because we think it's such a simple algorithm, and why don't they get it? Okay, and in hindsight, I understand why they don't get it. Okay. So here's the algorithm. If it's just one machine, you just schedule things by the finishing times, increasing finishing times, and then you want each interval, if it doesn't conflict with the previous things, take it. That's greedy. Right? Live for today. And if it does conflict, you can't take it. Throw it out. Okay? Making those irrevocable decisions. If it's many machines, then you see it could possibly fit on many machines. And you see, you try to put it on that machine that'll cause the least amount of gapping. You leave the least amount of space available. It all seems, in hindsight, reasonable and natural. Good. This is an optimal algorithm. This will schedule the optimal number of intervals. Now, you can ask, first of all, I want to argue, first of all, it's not even the obvious algorithm, right? The obvious algorithm, seems to me, is take the smallest job first, the one that takes the least amount of time. That's the greedy. If you had any notion of greedy, that would be the greedy thing. Okay. So even in the simplest of problems, there's nothing really natural or unnatural as to what one's allowed to do. And you have to ask yourself, does it matter where you schedule a job if you have a choice? And it does matter. And all that falls out of the analyzing these things. So then you ask, what about the weighted case? Does that have something very simple? And what would you try there? Well, you could try the same ordering. That'll give you a terrible approximation. And you could try taking the intervals with the most value first. That'll give you a terrible approximation. And probably the most natural thing is to take the processing time over the value. And that'll give you a terrible approximation. So all these things just don't work. Okay? And there are various generalizations in these problems, which are NP hard. So let me just move on from that. But you don't have to go far to get problems which are simple generalizations of this, which we don't understand very well at all. This previous problem we at least have optimal algorithms for, but not by simple algorithms. Here's how to do a problem where if instead of a job fitting in exactly in an interval, you have a window of time in which the job fits. And again, unweighted. And then there's just an adaption of this where you have to use an adaptive algorithm for it. And the only thing interesting about this is that in this case, the more machines, the better the approximation you get. Okay, so it limits to something like 1.6 or something like that. That funny ratio there. As m gets bigger, it goes to whatever e over e minus 1. So that seems to improve with the number of machines, which is a little bit sometimes counterintuitive, but it does. And so what can we say about this? What we can say is, at least in this framework, that you cannot do this optimally. You cannot do the weighted problem optimally. And this is a simple proof, but it's still, it's illustrative of the kinds of things you can do. In fact, if you look at this natural notion of sort of the maximum profit you get per amount of time you're taking, over the minimum of that, that's sort of a natural limitation on how much you can get by these simple algorithms. And in particular, if you have proportional profit, where every job has value equal to its length, every interval has value equal to its length, then if you schedule the longest ones first, that is, you do the greedy thing here, then you get a 3 approximation. That's the best you can do in this framework. Okay? And and you can prove some negative results, nothing fantastic. It turns out that if you want, and that's a fixed approximation, a fixed priority, right? If you schedule everything by the longest intervals first, you're fixing that interval, and you're fixing that ordering, right? Once and for all, you fix that ordering. But if you do that more adaptively, you can improve upon that ratio, okay? And then you can say something about lower bounds, and I didn't write it down, but the lower bounds actually get worse and worse in some sense, get closer and closer to 1. The negative results deteriorate as you have more machines, and we don't know what the right bounds are at all. So here's this challenge in order to take this problem that everybody believes is solved, and I claim how to view it as an unsolved problem. And the way to view it as an unsolved problem is to say, well, okay, in many cases it's not good enough to solve something in time n squared or n cubed or n fourth. You really want to solve it in something close to n or n log n. Okay? Many of these greedy algorithms have time n log n. There's some sorting involved, which is n log n, and then you're often running very fast. Okay? So you can solve this problem by dynamic programming in time n to the m, if there's m machines. And I'll say how to do that. And there's a min cost max flow algorithm, which I won't talk about, which solves it in, say, n squared log n. But these are more complicated algorithms, certainly not achieving time n log n like we have for the unweighted case. Okay? And so that's the question. What can you do if you were really restricted to n log n? Could you get very good approximations or not? Okay? And we don't know how to answer a question like that. Okay. And now what I'd like to argue is that, using this example, is that this framework, okay, so we can prove negative results in this framework, but the framework, then you have to start saying to yourself, well, how good is the framework? Did it really capture all the things I want to do? Well, one of the things about a framework is you see the limitations, and you start to ask yourself, what else can you throw in? And that's what I think is the positive side of this, is that it starts to suggest other algorithms. Okay, and one of those previous things I talked about came about that way, but not too many. So you can talk about what is an input item. I said an input item, say, in the interval thing was the starting time, the finishing time, and the value. Well, you could say, well, tell me all the things it intersects with. that wouldn't be too good to do because it would introduce too big of a description. But you could say simply, tell me the number of things it intersects with. Right. And the more information you throw in, the more possibilities you have, okay, for what is a good ordering. There are certain things called all the things I've been talking about today are best in. In some sort of sense, you're trying to, when you think about it, you're throwing things in sort of one by one in the best way. Another way is to start with everything and start throwing things out. Okay, that's another type of greedy algorithm, but doesn't get used too often, but does have some application. Another thing to do is instead of just computing one solution, here we're computing in this greedy algorithm one solution that we keep on augmenting. But instead, let's, you know, keep 10 or 100 or n solutions or n squared solutions. Can you do something very well then? Okay, and this is going to fall into a model which we call the priority backtracking model, which I'll mention in a few seconds, where we can say things about that too. It'll be a starting, the priority will be a starting point for that. We can allow some look ahead. Okay, we could say, well, let's find the next three things in the ordering, and what will we do now? Okay, now that turns out to be a very subtle point. Because if I say, look at the next three things, look at the next two things and take the second one instead of the first one. Or look at the ordering and take the median instead of the first one. Those become non-IIA. Those are no longer satisfy the IIA axiom, and now the proofs become much more complicated, or if at all. Okay, that's something which doesn't appear very much. No reason can't. It's equally easy to do that, but we just don't know how to analyze those things. There's something called the local ratio type of algorithms, also called primal dual things, or relation, where instead of making irrevocable decisions, you put things on a stack. Some things you put on the stack, some things you throw away, and then you clean up the stack at the end. You just pop the stack at the end and create a feasible solution that way. Okay? And now you can get constant approximations, and in fact, for one machine, you can get an optimal algorithm like that. There is an optimal algorithm that'll put things on a stack and then pop the stack and get optimality for this problem, but not for two machines already. Okay? And then in general, that suggests two-pass algorithms or multi-pass algorithms, where you go through one pass and make some decisions about some of the items, and then you have another pass for the remaining items and another for the remaining items. That seems like a kind of a very natural paradigm. I've seen maybe only one or two examples of that. And in terms of analyzing it, I have no idea how to analyze that generality of an algorithm. Because most of our proofs are about information theoretic limitations. And at any point of the computation, even if I'm creating many solutions in parallel, I have some partial knowledge about what I don't know. In this, if I do this pass by pass, it's not clear what I don't know. Or as Socrates says, I know what I don't know. Okay. So it seems like this is a challenging thing, but not impossible again. This is such a restricted paradigm. Why can't we prove things about it? Okay. And then here's something else, which for packing problems, which makes perfect sense. Instead of making just a totally irrevocable decision to take an item or not take an item, these scheduling things, let's say if I throw away an item, I won't consider it again, but I'm allowed to take an item temporarily. And the only restriction now is that at any point in time I maintain a feasible solution. Okay? So this is sort of like priority with revocable acceptances. And here we can see now that same weighted problem, say here's how to do this weighted interval selection by an algorithm like that that does achieve a constant approximation. Not as good as two, but something like four. In that framework, Stephanie Horn proved that you still have limitations, and there's other problems for which UVA proved there's limitations. So you can prove, again, this is the model in which you can prove limitations, somewhat more general than the original priority model. And now let me mention a little bit about in the remaining 5 minutes, and here's a good example of how fast I can talk. And by now, even though I was introduced as a Torontonian, my New York accent will start to come out, and I can't help it at this speed. If we move on to something like dynamic programming, this is really a much more complicated kettle of fish. I mean, the people in operations research have thought about this, and they tried initially, and as I said, Bellman didn't like anybody. I don't think there was anything that too much that came out of early attempts to formalize it. I'm going to mention a way to formalize a very restricted class that we came up with for dynamic programming. It's called simple dynamic programming, and it follows exactly the use of that word by Boehringer. And it just means that for those who know dynamic programming, when you set up a dynamic program as a recursive program, the proof of its, say, optimality or the proof that it works is based upon an induction on the number of things that you put in the solution so far, or could have put in the solution so far. Not all things work that way. So here's how to do the weighted case. This is like a one-line algorithm for doing the weighted case in dynamic programming. At any point in time, I want to say, what's the optimal? I want to order the jobs by their finishing time. And then I want to ask myself for each I, what's the optimal amount of profit I can make if I only consider the first I jobs? And this recursion gives you that answer. And if you think about it, and this is a question I get asked, why is this not a greedy algorithm? Because if you think about this maintaining many solutions at once, because I have to, my choice really is to take the ith item or not take the ith item. That is to take the ith job or not. And if I take it, then I have to, that rules out all the things it covers. And I have to be able to go back to something much previous, and I have to have that available for me. Okay? So that idea, I mean, as I say, the general idea is this collection of subproblems that you're computing at a very abstract level. But what is that collection of subproblems? Okay. Well, one way to formalize it, if you're just sort of doing it item by item, is what we called in a paper with some of my colleagues here, Avner Magen and Tony Potassi, as well as Misha Lechnovich Josh was a student, Burish was a student of Tony's, and Russell and Pagliasso, a model which generalizes the priority, where we think of it as instead of just in priority, we're computing one solution after the other. Now think of computing a tree of solutions, where we branch according to possible different decisions you could have made about that item. Did I take it? Didn't I take it? Of course, if you try all possible solutions, you get an exponential size tree, so you have a trade-off between, say, the size of the tree and say, the approximation that you're trying to achieve. Okay? And it turns out that you can also think of this, since you're creating a tree, you can think of creating a backtracking tree where you'll do this in some depth-first search. And that mimics certain types of SAT types of algorithms and other logic decision procedures. And so now, just the way to think about it, just as I say, this is every node is labeled by an ordering to figure out who you're going to look at next, and then you branch according to the decisions you want to make about it. And at any point in time, you can kill a branch for no good reason, and what you're trying to do is study either the size of these things, or the tree. And that's what all. You can prove another else in this. Point out is that if you generalize this idea about that optimal thing for one machine interval scheduling to n machines, then the bound you get is n to the m, as I mentioned before, and you can prove that this cursive dimensionality is necessary. That if you try to solve this problem by dynamic programming, in this style of dynamic programming, it's going to be exponential in m. Okay? You can prove things about, there's many other things you can prove about that, but it's about that problem, interval scheduling. You can prove things about the knapsack problem, more or less that you need exponential size, you want to get optimality, which we sort of know since it's an NP-hard problem. You can prove things about SAT problems, and then you have a huge distinction between fixed priorities and adaptive priorities. So the framework lends itself towards results, okay? And what I want to say, although it lends itself to some results, like for 3SAT, you need exponential sort of depth-first search tree to solve a 3SAT problem, just even the search problem. That at the leap, you have to come up with a satisfying assignment if there is one. Okay, that's even though that's exponential, there are the way it's set up. The example that turns out to be a simple linear algebra type of solution to it, so you're certainly not capturing everything, but you're certainly capturing something that gets done a lot. And that, though, is a tree formulation, and some people have made this into a DAG. Okay, and this is a paper that's not published yet by Burish, Oppenheim, Davidson, and Pagliasso, where they're taking this tree formulation and making it into a DAG and trying to prove what can and can't be done. And this becomes much more complicated. It still doesn't cover all dynamic programming, but it covers many more things. And it's in this environment that they have some evidence. I wouldn't say total a complete result, and that's why it hasn't been published yet. But they have good evidence that something like dynamic programming or this style of dynamic programming cannot officially solve bipartite graph matching, that you need flows. Okay? So we're starting to get formulations where our intuition is at least being confirmed. And then the final model I want to talk about is that what I talked about before, this two-stage types of primal dual or local covering, where you use the first stage to put things on a stack according to a priority scheme, and the second stage to clean it up. For covering problems, you want a minimal solution. For packing problems, you want a feasible solution. You use the popping stage to get feasibility. For the packing problems, for covering problems, use the popping stage to get minimality. And so here's like this algorithm again. Here's in the weighted case how you can, the weighted interval case, how you could do it in that environment. You have to sort of put things again by their finishing times, and then you keep on changing the weights of things according to what you've taken so far. And that sort of allows you to do this optimally for one machine. You get this bound 2 minus 1 over m, m the number of machines. And what we can formalize this is by the stack model, where you're using a priority algorithm to push things on the stack, and then a simple popping mechanism. And at least if it's a fixed order, like that previous algorithm is, we know you can't get optimality. But we really have very poor approximations, and this is already a very just beginning for that. Let me finish up by just sort of a little bit of open questions and reflections about this whole point of view. In general, I think everything we do in terms of getting lower bounds can be thought of as information theoretic lower bounds, and it's interesting to know just the limitations of this. Okay? And what you have to be very careful of is a sort of, again, the Turing tar pit. You can say at some very abstract level, dynamic programming just means I have an array of solutions, and I have an ordering on those elements of the array, and to compute any element of that array, I just have to look at smaller things in the array, things which come earlier in the array. And that sounds like a definition, except for that you can simulate any Turing machine that way. You have to really have a much better idea of what the way you actually formulate these dynamic programs to make a reasonable thing out of it. I really like the idea of extending the priority framework to these two-pass things, because I'm convinced that's something that really could produce new algorithms as well as non-IAA orderings. We didn't talk about randomization, but you can throw randomization into this, and there are some proofs, not too many, along those lines. Former student of mine, Spiros Angelopoulos, has results along those lines. We can view this backtracking model as a backtracking model, this PBT as a branching tree model as a backtracking model, but then more generally, how much information can you share between different paths on that tree becomes a completely open question. We have very good results about the trade-off between the size of these trees and the approximation results. Very hard sometimes to prove things about problems in graph theoretic problems where the vertices of the items. And in general, I guess the bottom line is, you name the problem, we almost can't prove anything about it. Mm-hmm. The significance. Okay, but these are very simple algorithms. Okay, I think they still go back to being simple algorithms. So let me go back to the. I've just talked about things that go in the style of item by item. There are other things about formalizing local search, which I think we have some ideas about. Formalizing problems that are not search and optimization problems. And then generally, again, I started off saying there is a theory of what an algorithm is. We know what reductions mean. We know, equivalence between different algorithms. What goes on here if we really try to formulate some broader class of simple algorithms? How are these different paradigms related to each other? What's the right notions of reductions? Is there some sort of theory of simple algorithms? Okay. And it's really amazing how little we know. And finally, my reprise back to the Holy Grail. So we haven't been able so far to come up with maybe only one or two new things, and then in hindsight they were already known anyway. Okay, so we haven't come up with a whole bunch of things, but I would say in a very similar field of online algorithms, where online algorithms are very special cases of these priority algorithms, where the ordering is given by an adversary as opposed to the algorithm, where people did come up with new algorithms. Surprising new algorithms that not only affected how online computation is done, but wound up creating new ways of embedding one metric space into another metric space, and have had kind of a real residual spin-off that's gone way beyond. And in general, for any kind of framework, for any model, for any sort of attempt to theorize about something, we don't know the consequences. I mean, you can ask and go back and say, you know, what's the benefit of the whole Turing model? We don't write algorithms in Turing's model, but it's a tremendous conceptual tool for us to understand ultimately what can and can't be done, just like the von Neumann model for computing. And so those models, I think, are very necessary. And even if you can't point to algorithms, sometimes I think the whole point of view is very important. But I'm hopeful that if we start to study these algorithms, these very simple algorithms, very systematically, we will start to generate new algorithms. And there are actually people out there, I'm not one of their believers, who think that once you've formalized algorithms enough like this, you can actually synthesize algorithms, or at least have some interactive system that helps you synthesize algorithms. And that would be, you know, don't worry about it, we'll still have plenty of work, but that would be very enticing to think that we could do that. So that's a good place for me to stop. Thank you.